Hey, good afternoon. Welcome to Reformation Rush Hour on Worldwide KFUO, KFUO.org. We're the messenger of good news. I'd like to invite you to go to that website, KFUO.org. You can find this program and so many other great programs archived there. Just go to the archives. You need to take your time, though, because I'll warn you, sometimes the site's a little slow, so click and just wait a couple seconds. Don't get impatient. That was my problem earlier today. I got impatient. I clicked and kept clicking, and I should have just let it sit.
Patience is a virtue.
That's true. That voice is the Reverend Dr. Dan Harmelink. Co-host, I guess, on Tuesdays. We could say co-host.
Something like that.
On Tuesdays.
And I'm not alone today.
Executive Director of Concordia Historical Institute.org. Go discover your Lutheran history. And also we've got Becky Wells in with us.
She's
the curator of said organization as well. But we're going to be talking to you guys a little bit more in depth about a guy who died 600 years ago.
Right.
For much of the same sort of thing that Luther was saying 500 years ago.
So we're in standby mode. We're just going to read Concordia Historical Institute Quarterly for the next 15 minutes.
You can read that, and also you can pitch in as we talk to our first usual Tuesday guest. There's nothing too usual about him, I guess. Pastor Walt Snyder, who has his own theme song. Hey, Walt, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing wonderfully. I'm glad we have an extra voice in there. Sort of drowns you out a little bit more.
Thank you. It's very appreciated, sir.
I'm so virtuous. I sit here on hold and listen to all this rattling and clanging and disjointed voices in the background while I'm waiting to go on each Tuesday. It's kind of fun trying to pick you and Dan out of the other four or five things I'm hearing in my phone at that time.
Hey, this is where it gets good right here.
Okay.
Now is a little bit ahead of myself. Sorry. We're not going to wait for it to get into the riff there. Hey, Walt. We're talking about patristics, church festivals, feasts, observances, all that kind of stuff.
Yes, indeed.
Who are we talking about today?
Well, we already talked about the guy who you're going to be covering in greater depth when we looked at his feast day a few weeks ago. So we're going to talk about some other people now.
All right.
Okay, well, we got five over the span because we've been gone for 2 weeks. I'm not going to cover the 2 weeks we missed, except for today. It's the commemoration of the holy prophet Ezekiel, who introduced really weird stuff to the biblical mindset with the visions that he had of the things around the throne of God and the four living creatures, things that even in describing them, they're almost indescribable.
And if I remember right, Ezekiel is one of those books that you had to be 30 years old to read in the Jewish tradition.
Yes, one of the ones, it was books where you must wash your hands. It was one of the rabbinical terms for them, where they could render you unclean because of the depth of the content. And Ezekiel, some of the stuff was the visions itself, and obviously the depraved nature of Israel. But the things were the Lord commands him to cook a fire or cook over a fire made of dry human dung, which was obviously, if you look at Leviticus, something that no Jew would ever do. But it was to prove a point to the people, and that's one of the few times where somebody really begged something else God, and where he actually relented on that particular one. But there's it's hard to understand if you don't have the whole context of the Hebrew history and aren't then also, of course, looking forward to Christ. If you try to interpret Ezekiel without Christ, just like any of the other books of the Bible, you're eventually going to run up against a stone wall.
Now, you mentioned the Ezekiel bread there, Walt, and I have to tell you, I've had a lot of fun in supermarkets talking to grocers about the Ezekiel bread that they sell there. Mm-hmm. And I like to inform them that if it's made properly, God relented, but he did say that he had to use cow pies. So there was that fuel that was prescribed. I don't think that the Ezekiel bread that you get at the market is cooked in the proper biblical mode.
No, but of course, if your roots were like in the steppes of Russia, or if you were a descendant of American pioneers heading west, there were a lot of people who cooked over things like that in your own family background, too, because the the heat index of good dry cow pie evidently is quite high, as were buffalo chips and all of those other things. So but you do with what you've got, which is also something that we've discovered from time to time in Scripture.
Anyway, I'm sorry, my digression. I just couldn't resist.
I know. But the message of Ezekiel, like in all the prophets, is the message of both condemnation and of hope. But there is going to be a restoration. And when you get in the latter parts of Ezekiel, it's as if the Lord is superimposing a heavenly temple or the New Jerusalem over the old and then the restored, rebuilt temple that is yet to come when the exiles get to go back to the Holy Land. And it's interesting how some of the measurements are the same or differ in different ways than to, and some of the offices that are expanded, and you see this prince of the people who's just sort of a background figure, but he's the one who makes sure the sacrifices are ready and things like that. And you see in him then another foreshadowing of Christ as you go through the book. So like I said, there's a lot of Jesus in there, but unlike Isaiah, sometimes you have to look a bit more attentively to make the connections and the comparisons that the Lord, I think, intended us to do. Now, that's enough on him if we're going to get done with all these people, probably.
Sure. Earthy guy. Let's move on.
Yes. Next one is one who is sometimes thought of as an earthy woman. That tomorrow is the Feast of St. Mary Magdalene. A lot of people think she was a prostitute, although there's absolutely no biblical warrant to call her that, because of the she was one who from whom the Lord cast seven demons. We know that. And some people associate her with the woman taken in adultery or with some other sinner at some time or another. And then not only was there a demonic possession, but then there was also a woman who had lived an immoral life. We don't have any evidence of that at all. We just know what we have right there. We do know that she was one who was devoted to Jesus throughout the entire course of his ministry, from the time he took her away from satanic bonds until the time he died. She was one of the inner circle. And in the early church fathers, she sometimes is called the apostle to the apostles, because apostle, of course, means one who is sent. And Mary was the one who was sent to the apostles, to the ones who were going to be sent, in order to tell them that Jesus was alive, as he had said. So she gets to see Jesus alive first. Then she gets to tell the others, who, of course, don't believe her because she's just a hysterical woman. And a side note from semantics. If you go to England and their two greatest universities, Oxford and Cambridge, they have what is, in England, in America, we would say Magdalene College and Magdalene College, spelled differently, but both of them pronounce them Maudlin. And that is then where we also get this English word Maudlin from the corruption of Magdalene, because in English, of course, Maudlin means somebody who is overly emotional, especially in a sad state. And so a lot of times Magdalene story is one that's both sad and kind of sappy. But the idea came that Mary was weeping at the tomb. Her eyes were red and that. And you'll see that sometimes in paintings of her and iconography and the like, that's emphasized in her then. So from her then, two great university colleges are named, and we have an English word that none of us really wants to be. What we should want to be is somebody who's as faithful as Mary was and who truly believed in the Lord, and then the Lord obviously thought so well of. And among all of the disciples and followers of Jesus, you get an idea that Mary might have been up in as close as, if not closer than, a lot of the 12.
She and Jesus had a very special, close relationship. And as you point out, you know, Mary's accused of all sorts of things. She was accused of being a prostitute. And, of course, there's all of this nonsense that goes around about Mary and Jesus being secretly married or having an affair, you know, all that kind of nonsense. There's no evidence that she was anything more than just a very devout Christian lady who knew that, you know, she was forgiven her sins and had some demons that got taken care of. You know, to speculate It's nothing more than speculation. And
that's true.
Yeah.
And for people who are interested, this one comes around every year, and then I grab a lot of these from the Aardvark Alley blog, and then tomorrow it will show a couple of links that go against the Dan Brown type heresies about that. And Mormonism also had a big thing about the marriage of Jesus to Mary Magdalene, if you look at some of their earlier writings. So if you're, if you got Mormons who are saying that Jesus and Mary were hitched up, or if you've got people who think that the Da Vinci Code is a good interpretation of the Bible, there will be a couple of links that pop up tomorrow that people can follow and get a little bit more information on that.
Very good. Who else do we have, Walt?
Well, the next one is St. James the Elder, the one of the Thunder Boys, John's older brother, and those Zebedee boys who Jesus called the Sons of Thunder, evidently loud, argumentative. You can see some of it, but yet also one of the three, along with Peter and his brother John, who was privy to some of the Lord's special events, including the Transfiguration, where Jesus took a few away from the 12. Those were the few who usually went with him then. Quite possibly that they were not just your entry-level fishermen. Their dad had servants, and they had certain social standing. John knew somebody who was in the high priest's household. So it could be that they had more wealth than a lot of their neighbors. They certainly gave up whatever they had in large part in order to follow Jesus, although they fell back on it a few times when things were going a little bit against where they thought they should. James and John, remember, were the ones who posed that they called down fire on the Samaritan village that rejected Jesus. And the other time there, and then their mother was involved in that. Let us get beside you when you come into your kingdom. James, though, is the only one whose martyrdom is recorded of all of Jesus' disciples, and it was around AD 42. Herod Agrippa, who was the grandson of Herod the Great, who had tried to kill baby Jesus, and nephew of Herod Antipas, who killed John the Baptist, you detect the theme in here. Yes, the Herods like to get rid of their enemies as completely and permanently as possible. And he then, and Antipas was also the one who examined Jesus on Good Friday and signed off with the other sin on his eventual suffering and death. And he was killed for being a follower of Jesus. They call him James Major, James Greater, or James the Elder, or some such, to distinguish him from any other disciples and others in the New Testament who are named James. And then in church tradition, he was, his remains were carried off to Compostela, Spain. And when the Christians were finally in a position to start driving the Moors, the Islamic invaders, out after their long occupation, San Diego de Compostela, St. James of Compostela, was one of the battle cries. Like, remember the Alamo was to the Texans. It was something that they rallied around. We were going to get these people who despise Christianity away from this place, which is blessed by the bones of the blessed Apostle James. So he has a strong Spanish connection, and you've got San Diego's not only in California but scattered around the world wherever there were Spanish, and a big part of Spanish Catholicism. And I guess move on to the next one.
Yeah, I thought that you had more to say about that, but sure.
Well, we've got a couple more to go yet. But quickly on the next one, Olav of Norway is on the 27th of July. He was one who, although he himself didn't always live the most Christian of lives, was sometimes quite brutal and heavy-handed, he also became interested in Christianity and eventually himself became a Christian. He declared himself king of Norway, and in those days it was sort of like being king of a lot of other places. You had to be pretty tough to hold on to it, and you could claim a big kingdom, but when there were petty kings all around you, holding on to it was a difficult thing indeed. He was eventually deposed, but then struggled to come back once again. Finally, he was struck down and killed, and not long after his death, then they disinterred his bones and brought them to the cathedral in Nidaros or Trondheim, and he then remained there. He became the patron of Norway, and he still is thought of extremely highly. His battle axe is part of the Norwegian coat of arms, held in the claws of a rather noble-looking lion. And while he didn't bring Christianity there, he did codify the faith. And his rules were set so much in people's hearts that when clerical celibacy was being insisted upon by the church at large, the Norwegian church flat off resisted it because Olaf had said that it wasn't supposed to be that way. So even papal orders weren't enough to get the Norwegian Christians to go against the decrees of their king. And eventually then some of that stubbornness probably is what led Norway to go wholeheartedly into the Reformation.
We have just about a minute left. Walt, who's the last one real quick?
Johann Sebastian Bach.
Heard of him.
Yes. Some people, they think it was Berlioz, but the story's a bit off in times, said there is no God but Bach and Mendelssohn is his prophet. This, according to a musician, was the quality of that he produced. Although in his own time, he was more known for being a player than a writer of music. And he was almost forgotten almost as soon as they buried him. Yet Mendelssohn started digging up his works and playing them and introducing them to all of Europe and finally the entire world. But Bach was such a great theologian. He wove his Christian faith and the text of Scripture throughout all of his music. You know, he said the music had he agreed with Luther, music has no higher purpose than glorifying God. And even with all of his secular works, his religious works to this day have the power to lift up the human heart and to point us toward Christ. A brilliant man, sometimes an arrogant man, but a man who could produce vast volumes of work and vast numbers of children, and from what some people say, also drink vast quantities of beer. He lived large in his import to the church and to the musical world are something that we still probably can't completely grasp.
Anyway, sorry we're out of time. We could do a whole hour on Bach, no problem. Pastor Walt Snyder, thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back on how to properly cook a goose on Reformation Rush Hour. Stay around.
Join Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and thousands of congregations across the country as they observe Refugee Sunday, a time to celebrate the gifts migrants and refugees bring to the United States. Pick a Sunday that works best for your congregation to celebrate. New resource kits, including bulletin insert and poster, will be available soon. Sign up for our newsletter at lirs.org/rebuildinghope.
Listening to Worldwide KFUO on the go with your smartphone doesn't mean you have to walk around with earbuds all day. You can Bluetooth across the room to a speaker system in your home or listen on radios that have built-in smartphone cradles. There are many easy ways to listen to WorldwideKFUO.org on the air, online, and on demand. We proclaim the clear gospel message of Christ crucified for our sins. The messenger of good news, Worldwide KFUO.
The book of Matthew tells us that the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. This July, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod focuses on ways we Lutherans serve each other and the world. See for yourself how Christ sets us free to love and serve our neighbor by visiting lcms.org/themes. That's lcms.org/themes.
So Planned Parenthood is harvesting parts of a body from a child that is not yet born. For what use could that possibly be? On the next Long Gospel, we will give you some information we have found out and also indicate why what is happening is, of course, contrary to God.
Weekday mornings beginning at 9:30 on KFUO.
Welcome back to Reformation Rush Hour, the fastest hour in radio history. Well underway. We just heard from Pastor Walt Snyder about all sorts of history stuff. And that's not the end of it, because it's time for more history stuff from the people at Concordia Historical Institute, the fine underwriters of this program. Concordia
just can't get enough history.
.org. Just got to throw in the .org at the end of Concordia Historical Institute. That's
right.
Reverend Dr. Dan Harmelink. And also we have in studio with us Becky Wells, who's the curator for the museum. Welcome, folks.
Thank you
it's
for having us.
Great to be back.
What's new in the world of CHI?
Well, we don't have unlimited time, but a lot's continuing to go on at the Concordia Historical Institute. So a lot of people are off for the summer. We're not off for the summer.
Well, when are you off?
Never.
Oh. The organization that
it's
never
Christ
sleeps.
It's Christ-redeeming work in the life of the Lutheran Church 24/7 at CHI.
That sounds like a lot of pressure.
Oh, we get 10 holidays a year.
Yeah, there you go. No, there's just so much to tell. I mean, the story just continues to go on. So instead of talking about Luther and the Reformation, we're going to talk about pre-Luther and the Reformation today.
Yes.
Before now, there was a swan, there was a goose.
That's and when we left off, I said how to properly cook a goose. It will make sense sooner or later if you don't know what I'm talking about. Becky, you're the curator. You guys have a couple exhibits right now, the physical ones that you can see either here at the International Center of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod or at your headquarters on the campus mm-hmm. of Concordia Seminary.
Yes,
what's going on with those exhibits before we talk about this exhibit?
Well, at Concordia Historical Institute on the seminary campus, we have a Papua New Guinea mission exhibit that is wonderful. Artifacts from Papua New Guinea natives. We have paintings from a missionary who painted the natives. So it's very informative. We have
pointy sticks.
Yes, we have spears. We have weapons. We have musical instruments. We have clothing. We have idols. You know, all of that. All of that we have there. So it's a great exhibit to see. And if you're wanting a broad history of the LCMS and the Lutheran Church, you can come to the museum here at the International Center, and you can go from Luther and the Reformation all the way through KFUO and Lutheran Hour. So,
yeah, and you guys have all sorts of really great information down there on the film that's coming up. I always want to say wrong. Is it Rosa Parks?
No, not Rosa Young.
Rosa Young.
First Rosa.
See, I always do that. And I know it's not Rosa Parks, but I always want to say that. Some interesting information about her life and work, how she became a Lutheran and a Lutheran educator. Some really interesting stuff on military chaplaincy. And you have CFW Walter's carriage. I think that it
and
was.
And his piano.
Wasn't it an Edsel, that carriage? I'm not sure.
It was a three-cylinder, I think.
All sorts of really, really cool stuff. If you're ever in the area, you can stop in and say, I want to see the museum. And
right. So those are open during the summer. And they're open during the week. But if you haven't checked out the Papua New Guinea exhibit, come soon. Because, again, people think, well, I'll see it in a couple months. And then they arrive at CHI the week after it's been taken down.
Yes.
So don't wait too long.
So you have the physical exhibits, but now you have a virtual exhibit as well.
We're in a new age.
You guys, CHI has caught up
because
to the 20th
century. Yeah, there's plenty of people listening that they think, well, I'm not within driving distance of St. Louis, so I'm just going to turn the radio station to something else. No, we want to be there for the whole church. We want to be there for the whole LCMS. So we're doing something a little different.
Becky, if I go to ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org, what will I find?
Well, you'll find a myriad of things, but if you want to see this exhibit, you would click on Exhibits and see this exhibit called Jan Hus, Reformer, Confessor, and Martyr.
Now, I have the exhibit in front of me here. And it's pretty in-depth. You have an introduction, a timeline, early life, stance, schism, controversy, schism for those of you who like to add the C, exile, Council of Constance, legacy. You've got a lot of stuff here.
We do. And you didn't mention the artifacts we have pictured and photographed as well, all of medals from our Reformation coin and medal collection. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of this guy. He's born in 1373-ish. I guess we were talking during the break.
For those people who say Jan who?
Jan Hus.
Yes. His surname comes from the town he was born in, and if I butcher how to pronounce it, Husinec, in Bohemia, which for those of you like myself who, when I started researching this, thought, where is that? That is where the Czech Republic is now.
Prague.
Yes, Prague was the center of the capital of Bohemia. So his last name, as you talked about cooking the goose, his last name means goose. So that is who we are talking about, Cooking Hus. He was a martyr for the church. And one of the things that most impressed me when researching this was the similarities and the parallels between his life and Luther's. Mm-hmm. I have grown up in the Lutheran church, and I have heard of Luther. I have learned much about Luther, but seeing that he wasn't the first, he was in a long line of reformers, was very interesting. There's the similarities between them include they were born peasants from peasant families. They studied and learned, became pastors. The professors, Hus taught and became rector of the University of Prague. He also, preaching in the common language, that was important to both of them. Mm-hmm. Hus actually was at Bethlehem Chapel, which was where preaching happened in the common language. And he was very popular. He was a bold preacher like Luther, very popular with nobility. So there's a lot of parallels to their life. And it doesn't stop there, because they both wanted to reform the church. They saw failings. Hus was greatly influenced by John Wycliffe. His writings came to Bohemia from England, and Hus really spoke to him, the idea that scripture, everything needed to be based on scripture. Scripture was the truth, was God's truth. And so we see him then preaching Wycliffe's teachings. Well, then that caused some issues.
That got him into some trouble.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting. If you track the Bible and the way that it was translated into the language of the peoples, Jerome, who created the Vulgate in Latin, he did that because that was the common language. That was the language that all the literate people would read. Vulgate for vulgar, which means common. And so that became the official language of the church, was the Latin, and the cultures moved beyond Latin into their own regional languages and everything, and then it was blasphemy to take it from the vulgar and make it vulgar in the common sense. And so Wycliffe gets hammered for this. Hus also gets in trouble for this. What else do we know about Hus besides his love for getting the word of God out in the language of the people?
Well, he became this synodal preacher, which basically he, in many ways, tattled on the other clergy to the archbishop. And he had this...
In a good way.
Yes.
No one likes a fink.
No. But we see him in this place of prestige for a while, but his teachings then, and especially his speaking out against some of the corruption in the church, indulgences, other immorality with the clergy, did not make him any friends. Mm-hmm. And so we see him lose his prestige. And all amongst this time, he is trying to reform, to change the problems and the corruption in the church. He is trying to speak out against, speak for the scriptures, looking to the scriptures as the basis for all theology and doctrine. There is this whole controversy going on in the church at the time. This was the, if you've ever heard of the term papal schism, I'm pronounce the C there. so this is where there were two popes in the church, one sitting in Rome and one in France, in Avignon, I'm horrible.
You're doing fine.
Languages. so
two popes at the same time? How could that happen?
There's this whole controversy and who are you backing and all of this in the church. Well, there was a council in Pisa called, and the idea that we just need to get rid of both of the popes and start anew with a new one. Well, they did that. They elected a new pope. And under the name Alexander V. And all that did was add a third person to this, to vie for the crown. And so
now you've got three guys saying, I'm the Pope. No, I'm the Pope. No, I'm the Pope.
Yes, pretty much. And so Huss comes into this controversy because he did not back. He wanted to stay neutral, and he did not back who the archbishop backed. So then suddenly he is not in favor with the archbishop, and some of his teachings then are brought to the forefront then, rather than being looked aside.
So because he was kind of, I assume, pretty known when all of this is going on, there's a lot of pressure bearing on him to say, hey, which of these horses are you backing over here, Jan?
Right.
And so he steps back and he says, well, none of them. I'm just going to let it work its way out and see what happens here, right?
Right. And he was following King Wenceslas at the time, was the king of Bohemia. And so he was following what the king commanded and stayed neutral. But staying neutral, really, then once the Council of Pisa decided on Alexander, then basically went with the new pope.
He's out, yeah.
Well, this caused problems, and the archbishop brought some of the issues with Huss and Huss teaching Wycliffe's teachings. So we then see Alexander write a papal bull against Wycliffe's teachings, and so Huss then is excommunicated, and he's called to Rome. In the meantime, we get a new pope. There's a lot of popes in this story, and that's why on the exhibit we have a persons and events list if you get confused. But we see him called to Rome. He's fearful for his life, so he decides to not go, and has a greater excommunication placed on him. And this forces him into exile because basically it was an excommunication on the whole city of Prague to not be preaching.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, Becky, let's take a break right mm-hmm. here. We'll come back with more on the fascinating story of Jan Hus. We're talking with Becky Wells and Dr. Dan Harmelink from Concordia Historical Institute. We'll be right back after this.
The world is the mission field of Worldwide KFUO. We bring the gospel of Christ to all nations. Worldwide KFUO reaches countries where missionaries on the ground can't go. Christ called us to proclaim the gospel to all nations, and that's what we do here every day at Worldwide KFUO. If our mission and worldwide outreach is important to you, would you please prayerfully consider supporting Worldwide KFUO at KFUO.org.
Reverend Dr. Matthew C. Harrison of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod recently said these words regarding the importance of the work of Concordia Historical Institute.
When you forget your past, you forget the gospel. You become locked into your own little part of time. As you study the past and know the past and know what happened in the past, you see God at work and you see Christ.
Discover your Lutheran history at ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org.
This is By the Way. I saw this cartoon the other day as Winnie the Pooh and Piglet are walking together one day. Winnie turns to Piglet and says, "What day is it?" And Piglet replies, "It's today." And Pooh thoughtfully responds, "Oh, my favorite day." What would it be like to wake up excited about the day ahead and close the day, equally excited about the day just lived? Maybe we're more accustomed to arrive at the end of the day just wanting to fall into bed and hope the next day goes better. When God created the world at the end of each day, we're told, He saw that it was good. Perhaps the key to a good day begins by praying, "Dear Lord, make this day your own. Then I can be glad and rejoice in it." This is By the Way.
Who were Neanderthals? This is Ken Ham, president of Answers in Genesis and the Ark Encounter. Evolutionists used to believe that Neanderthals were primitive brutes, but today we know that Neanderthals buried their dead with rituals, made musical instruments, used fire, and hunted and trapped prey. Because Neanderthals did the same things that humans do, those who start with the Bible know that Neanderthals must have been human, descendants of Adam and Eve just like us. Well, scientists are now admitting that Neanderthals were much more intelligent than once thought, and we now know that many people living today have Neanderthal DNA in their genes. The evidence confirms a biblical model. Neanderthals were humans just like us. There's no such thing as a less evolved human.
Discover more about supposed human ancestors when you visit our website at answersingenesis.org. Learn about a biblical model of life's origins at answersingenesis.org.
Back to Reformation Rush Hour. You're listening to us on Worldwide KFUO. We're the messenger of good news. Want to point out once again that if you go to KFUO.org, this program and so many others are available for download. If you go to the archive section, you can also go to iTunes and subscribe. I'll come straight to you. I make house calls, apparently. I didn't even think about that before. With me in studio, the Reverend Dr. Dan Harmelink and Becky Wells from ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org. Go discover your Lutheran history over there. And we're talking about Jan Hus, who was a precursor to Martin Luther. Now, Becky, you were telling the story about Jan Hus, but I think that it's important that we step back a little bit and we realize that there has always been this thread of the gospel throughout the history of the church. Even in the darkest days, there's always been that thread of the gospel, and Jan Hus is part of that thread. Carries through. You also have another guy on here, Savonarola, who was down in Milan, and the Bonfire of the Vanities came from him. But once again, another guy who was teaching justification by grace through faith alone in Jesus Christ. And then, of course, comes Martin Luther. And so anyway, we're talking about Jan Hus, and it sounds like at this point, Jan has managed to get dragged into church politics, and he finds himself exiled.
And excommunicated.
Alone. Right.
Yes. So he is exiled, and if you know the story of Luther, we see more parallels. In his exile, he translated the Bible into the Bohemian language, the common language. He wrote letters, treatises, hymns. He was fruitful during his exile in the 1400s. We then the his exile ended when there was another church council, the Council of Constance. The Holy Roman Empire emperor at the time, King Sigismund, he wanted to resolve this schism in the church. And so he called this council, they called the council, and they called Hus to make a decision about the accusations of heresy against Hus with what he was teaching.
Uh-oh.
So he has promised safe passage to the council, which is in what is now Germany, from Prague. Well, he travels there. He goes there. He's there about a month. And then his safe passage apparently runs out. And he is imprisoned. He was under many hardships. And he came assuming he would be able to defend his stance with the scriptures. However, mm-hmm. he was really only brought there to recant. And mm-hmm. when he refused to recant his teachings, they would not allow him to defend his teachings.
And we see that in Luther, too, right? Before the emperor. And Luther thinks he's going to have his day in court. Well, no day in court. Either you renounce all your writings or not, or suffer the consequences. So same thing with Jan Hus.
Well, and likewise, you have this safe conduct promised, but now that one is pronounced a heretic, well, you don't have to honor safe conduct for heretics. So it's not like they're human anymore, right?
Right, right. Unfortunately, Hus's story ended a little differently than Luther's. Mm-hmm. He was pronounced a heretic, sentenced a month later to death by burning, and he was burned at the stake then on July 6th, 1415. So we see 600 years later, we are commemorating his life and his work because he was an early reformer. He brought about change in his area, Bohemia, and he even influenced Luther.
Yeah, I had said at the beginning how to properly cook a goose, and this is what I got to, was Hus being burned at the stake. But Luther is accused of being a Hussite at one point in his life, and he says, who? And then he finds out about Hus, and he says, oh, by gum, I guess I am a bit of a Hussite, aren't I? Mm-hmm. The parallels are astonishing, and I can't help but to think that, Dan, you pointed out the protection that Hus didn't get. Tell us about right. Luther's
protection. Well, this was haunting Luther that he's in the Wartburg protected from the edict that anyone that kills him is doing a good work. So I think Luther, it was beyond him why God would allow a just man like Jan Hus to suffer burning at the stake. And again, as far as we can tell, sometimes the executioners were merciful and strangled the person before actually being burned. With Jan Hus, the best evidence is that he was alive during this burning. I mean, talk about a horrific fate.
It is but awful.
But here we see that Luther's protected by his prince, and for whatever reason, God allows Luther to live and to continue his ministry. So again, this is completely beyond us. The comfort is God used Hus even in this horrific death to spread the gospel and to influence people for generations. And it's one of those things that we just don't have a good answer for, why Luther was saved and Hus was not. But the legend goes that Hus, at his death, announces, you can surely burn this goose, but in 100 years, a swan will come that you will not be able to silence. And this gets us ready for the dawn of the Reformation.
And so Luther, who's now, what is it? His family crest has a swan in it or something like that? Or did he just take that into his crest or something to that effect?
I think the swan of Wittenberg is the kind of the nickname of Luther came later.
Hmm. In relation to
as this legend was pinned on him.
That's pretty cool. You know, you make a point also that the job of the prince in Luther's time was to protect his people. The people owed him allegiance, but he owed them protection. And the prince protected Luther because that was his obligation.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't even a Lutheran at the time. He was still Roman Catholic, but you're not going to get my monk was basically the idea. So Luther is protected by this. Also, one of the things that isn't occurring during Hus, a couple of different things, and maybe you'd be interested in commenting on this, is the rise of Islam that is making its way all the way to Vienna in Luther's day. And so the Holy Roman Empire needed the German princes, whereas in Hus's day, was his prince needed in such a way? I don't know.
Right. Becky and I were talking about this earlier, that, you know, we hear in the Gospels, in the fullness of time, right? And we see this with Luther and the Reformation, too. You have the printing press,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You have the Turk at the door. All of these things come together. God brings them, uses them. In order with Luther and the Reformation, really explode the gospel all over Europe. But I think we have to remember Jan Hus and Savonarola and these other reformers, Wycliffe. They also contributed to this thread that you were talking about, this preservation, this remnant of the gospel. And so, unfortunately, I mean, it's shameful how many Lutherans have never heard about Jan Hus. And for centuries, and I think the coins and medals of the last 500 years point to this, that there's always been the closest of connections between Jan Hus and Martin Luther.
Hmm.
And we've gotten to the point that we're so illiterate when it comes to the history of the church. You know, this is not taught in confirmation class. Jan Hus has been relegated to our forgetful memory. So this exhibit, and again, you know, you take a look online. You don't have to be living in the St. Louis area to learn about this pre-reformer, if you want to use that term.
Now, you're a medals guy. I mean, you really are probably the synod's leading medal expert, mm-hmm. which probably just you anyway. But
we have monthly meetings, sorry. And it's me and myself and I.
I'm the leading expert on my shoes.
Right.
But you have some pictures of some medals on the website. Could you tell me a little bit about some of these medals?
Sure. So the Hus medal, as far as a Reformation medal or an opportunity through coins and medals to give witness to the gospel, this goes way back to the time of Luther. So when Luther's still alive, we would see these Hus medals being minted as a proclamation, as a reaching out with the gospel. So one of the earliest coins that we have in the CHI collection, as far as Reformation coins and medals, is this medal struck in 1530 with Hus, his portrait on one side, and a depiction of him being burned at the stake on the other side. So very early in the Reformation, Hus was claimed as one of our own.
Do you know where this medal was struck and for what occasion?
Somewhere in Germany. I don't. 1530 would be, you know, the time of the Augsburg Confession.
So this medal.
So some of the parallels that we talked about this hour were also seen by people at in the time of Luther.
Then you have another medal here, and this is a newer one, 2015, yeah.
This is designed by Scott Blazek and being sold right now by American Lutheran Publicity Bureau. And again, it commemorates this year being the 600th anniversary of the martyrdom of Jan Hus. So we have Lutherans all over North America that are being kind of reintroduced to Hus and his place in church history.
It's fantastic. And Scott Blazek is such a great mind, also pastor up in Wheaton, Illinois. and a wonderful pastor, and a beautiful, beautiful coin that's struck here, the metal that's struck here. So to wrap it all up here, is there anything else about Jan Hus that is worthy of mention? Crickets. I was going to throw out simply that Hus had advocated, and much like Luther, mm-hmm. communion in both kinds, that being the bread and the wine. And that was something that he was not appreciated for by the Roman Catholic Church. Although he advocated it, apparently he never actually practiced it. And he was put to death before he ever got the chance to do that. But I think also that shows a churchman mm-hmm. who might advocate for something, but he has enough sense of the church as a whole that he wouldn't actually do it without the consent of his fellow pastors and bishops and so forth.
He was a churchman, right? So
yeah, not just a radical reformer, but someone who has a proper understanding of the church. And mm-hmm. we have many pastors, even within our own fellowship, that won't institute certain things for the sake of the church, even though they might believe that it's right. And so you have some congregations that have early communion, for instance, whereas other congregations won't, because it's kind of a scandal mm-hmm. in certain congregations.
We see that in Luther, too. Reasons. Yeah, we see that in Luther, too.
Anything else coming up at CHI? Any new online exhibits?
Check out this online exhibit. If you have comments, feel free to shoot them to myself or to Becky. It's a fantastic exhibit, and it's available to everybody. This is a delight for us to offer it to. If you've got a computer, ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org. Check out our other exhibits too there.
Well, I have to also say that this is very exciting for me because I'm going to Prague next month. I almost said next week. Next month, I'm going to Prague. My wife and I are going to check it out. Little vacation. Also to meet
check it out.
Let's see what you did there. Also meet with the wonderful people at St. Michael's Church over there. It is St. Michael's. Yes, it is. Anyway, until next time, may the Lord bless you and keep you in his grace to life everlasting. Dan and Becky, thanks so much for being with us today.
Blessings. Thanks for having us.
God bless. We'll see you later. Stick around. Evening prayers up next on Worldwide KFUO. See ya.